Good morning, everyone.
Reading in Book 2, Canto 8. Perhaps this is the most dreadful and difficult passage of the whole poem, when the mother was working with Huta, illustrating passages from the poem. She said, I don't want to make any illustrations for this. So there are no passages recorded in mother's voice. There are no corresponding paintings. What the wonderful music which we just heard.
Divine humor.
Belongs to the end of Canto 7. And at the end of our session today, we'll hear the first music of Canto 9. We already read the whole canto through, and last week we looked closely at the first section, which ends on page 222 at the break. In the last lines of that section, describe how King Aswapati saw a shape, illimitable and vague, sitting on death, who swallows all things born. A chill, fixed face with dire and motionless eyes, her dreadful trident in her shadowy hand outstretched, she pierced all creatures with one fate. This is the mother of evil, who is mentioned in the title of this canto. Aswapati is exploring the world of falsehood. He becomes aware of the mother of evil and the sons of darkness. Not darkness in a physical sense, but the darkness of the most perverted and distorted lower levels of life consciousness. So those lines are a first description of this dreadful figure. And in the next section, Sri Aurobindo tells us more about this being. First of all, how she has come into existence. That comes in this next section. Will you start, please, Patty?
Where are we exactly?
At the break on page 222.
When nothing was save matter without soul, and a spiritless hollow was the heart of time, then life first touched the insensible abyss, awaking the stark void to hope and grief. Her pallid beams smote the unfathomed night in which God hid himself from his own view. In all things, she sought their slumbering mystic truth, the unspoken word that inspires unconscious forms. She groped in its deeps for an invisible law, fumbled in the dim subconscious for his mind, and strove to find a way for spirit to be. But from the night another answer came. A seed was in that nether matrix cast, a dumb, unprobed husk of perverted truth, a cell of an insentient infinite. A monstrous bird prepared its cosmic form in nature's titan embryo, ignorance. Then in a fatal and stupendous hour, something that sprang from the stark inconscient sleep, unwillingly begotten by the mute void, lifted its ominous head against the stars, overshadowing earth with its huge body of doom, chilled the heavens with the menace of a face.
Thank you. We have read in the end of Canto 3 another version of this story, how the young gods involved in matter have aspired for life to waken up matter, so that soul and spirit could be expressed in the material world, and how she, this gracious, great winged angel of life, descended and poured all her beauty and her bliss on the earth, hoping to fill a fair new world with joy. You remember this. But while the magic gift was on its way, before it could reach our hearts, a dark, ambiguous presence question all. So by the end of Canto 3, we see life on earth has become completely swallowed up in unconsciousness of matter and lives at the mercy of death, completely changed from its true origin. So here Sri Aurobindo tells us the same story in a much profounder way, the way that when life first touched insensible abyss, this world in which there was only matter without senses, she has come to awake this stark emptiness that is the universe, to wake it up to hope and grief. Her power comes just as a pallid beam, pale sunbeam, penetrating that night of nothingness, in which, the poet says, God hid himself from his own view. Elsewhere, Sri Aurobindo has given us this image of God playing with nature in a kind of game of hide and seek. But who hides and who is seeking? Basically, it is himself. But this life, nature, penetrating the darkness, her intention is to seek for the mystic truth, slumbering, sleeping in matter, in unconsciousness. She's looking for that unspoken word, that word of creation that will inspire unconscious forms first to exist and then to evolve. That force, she's groping in the depths of God, those deep, dark levels, looking for an invisible law. She's fumbling in the dim subconscious, seeking his mind. She's struggling to find a way for spirit to be, to exist in forms in our universe. That's her intention. That is what she's been missioned to do. But from the night, another answer came. A seed was sown in that lower matrix, a matrix, a womb that gives birth. And that seed, it says, is just a husk of perverted truth. The truth has been distorted completely. It's a cell, a first living cell of an insentient infinite, an infinity without senses and feeling. And from that seed, a monstrous birth prepared its cosmic form. Terrible distortion enters the universe in nature's titan embryo. That embryo that will be born, it's so powerful, but it is ignorance. There's no true spiritual knowledge there, no truth. So, in that moment, in a fatal and stupendous hour, something that sprang up from the sleep, the utter sleep of the inconscient, unwillingly, unintentionally begotten by the silent emptiness. It's just happened like that by accident. That something lifted its ominous head against the star, overshadowing Earth with its huge body of doom. This story, this event, is mentioned in many ancient traditions. The birth of falsehood, how can it come about? So this is one version.
And just hearing now the secret of the Veda by Sri Aurobindo, and exactly to know about this process, it is what his the rishis had been saying in words in the OC, in all the Veda.
They have been what?
They have been all this process, how this darkness takes up and how we have to aspire for the higher guidance and higher ones to overcome it, exactly this process.
So I can remind you again about Mother's explanation to Huta about the first line of the poem. It was the hour before the gods awake. And there she has told this story, which she's told in other versions at other times to other groups, to other people. I think I mentioned it last week, that there were these four great beings, power of bliss, of life, of truth, consciousness. They were given the power, the mission to create this manifestation. But when they were sent out, they felt so strong in their... I mean, this is the way she says it. She says it's only a story, but it's a way of understanding it. Each of them felt so strong that they cut their consciousness with the divine, cut their connection with the divine origin. And immediately each of them turned into its opposite. Bliss turned into suffering, truth turned into falsehood, life turned into death, consciousness turned into unconsciousness. And so she describes how that creation, which was supposed to be so beautiful, instead it has become dark, unconscious, twisted, perverted. And once, I think, only once, she doesn't mention it in this About Savitri account to Huta, but in one of her talks to the young people of the ashram in the playground, she said, when the mother realized what had happened, this terrible thing that has happened, she turned to the Lord and said, look, Lord, what is to be done? And in response, he has emanated a seed, pure love, pure divine love has been cast into the darkness. And because of that seed of pure divine love, then there's a possibility for the souls to wake up and for all this error and falsehood to be turned back to their true origin. That's why at the end of the poem, Savitri says, to feel love and oneness is to live. And this, the magic of our golden chain, through the power of divine love, that the whole thing can be turned around. And Aswapati is an agent for bringing that about. We've seen in Book 1, Canto 5, how he, with the knowledge that he's gained through his yoga, through his tapasya, he realizes that there must be a possibility of changing this suffering, imperfect world, bringing a divine life here. And he sets out with this as his mission, to find the power that can do that. And so we have him on this journey. Here he's still on his journey, on his quest, exploring as a representative of humanity all the planes of existence, find power that can bring the rule of truth again on earth. And he's about to reach the deepest, darkest point of his quest before he can start the upward journey. It happens in this canto. He's seeing all the darkest levels underlying our existence. Yes.
Greed leaves always the question.
Why can I repeat?
It leaves always the question for me, why did this happen in the first place?
Why was it allowed?
Yes.
So this question is not answered.
together with that question, what I asked, I think the two times before, what has been created? Together with that.
So this is just now what we're reading. You can read it. Page 223. You can start at the second line. A nameless power.
A nameless power, a shadowy will arose, immense and alien to our universe, an inconceivable purpose none can lodge. A vast non-being robed itself with shape. The boundless meshes of the unconscious depths covered eternity with nothingness. A seeking mind replaced the seeing's will. Life grew into a huge and hungry death, and the spirit's bliss was changed to cosmic pain, assuring God's self-cowled neutrality. A mighty opposition conquered its face, a sovereign ruling falsehood, death and grief. It pressed its fierce
hegemony
on the earth, disharmonizing the the original standard of the architecture of Earth, Bates Eason. It falsified the primal cosmic will and bound the struggle and dread
vicissitudes.
Vicissitudes, the long slow process of the patient problem.
We can stop there. So this is what has been created, this nameless power, this shadowy will. He says it's immense and it's alien to our universe. It doesn't belong here. But he says there is a purpose behind, an inconceivable purpose none can gauge. We can't find out the reason for that purpose. For us it is inconceivable, but because of that purpose, a vast non-being robed itself with shape. The Sanskrit word is asa. There's existence, sat, which is connected with satya, truth, underlying reality and truth of everything. But also it faces its opposite, asa. There are several places in the poem where Sri Aurobindo shows the opposition and the relationship between these two. So this vast non-being, the very opposite of the truth and reality, takes on a shape, a form, the boundless nescience, the not knowing, which is native to these unconscious depths of existence, covers up eternity with nothingness. We can even experience that eternity of nothingness. Savitri experiences it. Asvapati experiences it. It's the most terrible thing that the soul can experience, the awareness of an eternity of nothingness in which there's no divine, no love, no beauty, no bliss. And in the earth consciousness, the seeing soul, the soul with its power of truth vision, gets covered up by the seeking mind. That's the light that is left to us. Life grew into a huge and hungry death. That gracious great winged angel comes subject to death. Life can continue only by devouring other life. And the spirit's bliss was changed, cosmic pain. And God doesn't intervene. He keeps himself hidden. He says, I'm neutral in this situation. I'm not taking side. So this mighty opposition is able to take over space.
What is self-cowl?
Yes, a cowl is a hood. So it's as if God hides himself, as we read before. He's keeping himself hidden. He's not intervening in this situation. Keeping himself neutral. And that permits a mighty opposition to conquer space. And that mighty opposition is sovereign, it is ruling, but it's a falsehood, a sovereign, ruling falsehood. Death and grief presses its fierce hegemony on the earth. Hegemony, a kind of...
To be almighty?
Hmm?
To be almighty, to have hegemony? And French is absolute.
The absolute ruler, yes. But in political terms, we use it over the dominant power. Mm-hmm. There may be several minor powers, but the major ruling power has its hegemony, its superiority. And that upsets the whole original intention, the original style of the architecture of her fate, Earth's fate. It falsified primal, the original cosmic will, and bound to struggle and dread vicissitudes. Vicissitudes are all the unexpected things that happen, the unexpected catastrophes and disasters that come up. It bound to struggle and dread vicissitudes, the long, slow process of the patient power. The original conscious force of the divine, the mother who has emanated these beings who has taken up the task of expressing the Lord in forms, in individuality, in time and space. She's still at work, but now she has to work against all this opposition and all in the face of all these vicissitudes. But she goes on doing it, the patient power, the consciousness force of the Supreme. Yes, Margaret.
I have a question of the architecture of your faith, divine that is life, the origin of life.
Well, the architecture, I mean, it's the plan, what was supposed to happen.
But life.
Well, from the creative power of the divine. And it's got distorted, disharmonized.
I think the simple answer to why it had to happen in the first place is simply that what greater delight there is than coming out of the house of it. That's the whole plan of the universe. And that's why only Sri Aurobindo has revealed that, I believe, no? No, nobody else in the history of literature has had such a concept. But
it's still a mystery, isn't it?
Yes.
Hmm? I have a maybe simple reaction to that. My inward reaction is this should not have happened.
It should not have happened. No. It should not have happened. It wasn't it meant to happen, but it happened.
Well, he says it's self-cowled, you see. He purposely, purposely
for some reason, the divine is not interfering in this event. This inconceivable purpose that none of us can gauge, none of us can understand why. He hints at it at the end of book of Canto 3, when there's that fall of life, on page 130. I quoted to you these lines, before her gifts could reach our prison heart, a dark, ambiguous question. Ukananga.
And that next line.
So this explains.
It's the same idea of a cowl.
Yes.
Just put the. I just read in A.D. Purani's lectures on savitri. It says that pain is the goad. Without the pain, we wouldn't progress. We have to have something to push us.
Well, it wouldn't be like that if this distortion hadn't come. It's not the reason for it. But there's this secret will that robes itself with night and offers to spirit the ordeal of the flesh. It offers spirit this experience of pain. And in Book 1, Canto 2, there's this passage about Savitri. There's one dealt with her who meets the burdened great, the great spirits who come. They get faced with these difficulties, and there's some lord of the evolution who's in charge of that, and the greater the being, the greater the test that he gives.
In near-death experiences,
yes,
people nearly always describe this wonderful experience. And I just wonder whether the same falsehood dominates those subtle worlds that you enter when you die.
When you die.
As much as they control or influence material living.
Well, we know that after death people experience heavens and hells.
Yeah.
But it seems, and we were told, that in the early years of 20th century, the mother did a great deal of work in the subtle world, create a passage so that when the soul leaves the body, it doesn't have to pass through those hell, that it can go straight to the light. Whether it does so or not may depend on many factors, no? But we are hearing more and more accounts of people who have left the body sometimes in very, very painful and dreadful experiences, but they've immediately been welcomed into the light. So this is perhaps a great change that's been brought about by the work of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Definitely all of us who know their names, we can ask for protection. Sri Aurobindo, Meera, Sharana, Mama, in every situation.
If the divine had never turned into its opposite, love would not have come, is it not? Because Satchit Ananda is the divine, so Ananda is there, but love would not have come. The love is the redeeming power. You may say it shouldn't have happened, but then there wouldn't have been any love.
Of course, that's the way Mother mentioned it to the children.
Yeah.
But because because of this terrible wrong thing that happened, this even greater gift.
And the point is, it did happen, so you got stop it. We can reverse it, but we can't make it not it never happen.
Shall we go on?
Just one in line 109.
Yes.
A seeking mind replaced the seeing soul.
Yes.
So is seeking mind in a negative context here?
No, it's all we have. It's the light that we. I mean, of course, we have a seeing soul, but it's been covered up by this falsehood that's even in our very substance. So for us to find that seeing soul, it's not the spontaneous, natural thing that it should be, but we have to use the mind.
So seeking mind is a positive context?
It is, but it's not really a replacement for the seeing soul. Something that is covering it up. So, this process, this sovereign ruling falsehood. You like to read, please? Line 121, implanting error
in the stuff of things, in mad and ignorance of the all wise men. It baffled the sure touch of life's high sense. It kept the dumb of the intuitive guide in matters of sleep, deformed the insects. Instinct and the brute disfigured man's thought for humanity. A shadow fell across the simple ray, obscured was the truth light in the cavern of that once unwitnessed in the altar kept behind the still parliament space. Companioning the godhead of the same, thus with the dire antagonist energy born who minds. The eternal mother's mighty self and mounts her luminous infinity, which a great distorted silver in the night.
Let's pause there. So this is the distortion that happened, implanting error in the stuff of things, in matter itself, it made of ignorance of the all-wise law. Inherent in the creation, there was this all-wise law, but it's been covered up with ignorance. So life's hidden sense of what is true and right and must happen gets baffled, prevented from doing what it wants to do. There's an intuitive guide in matter's sleep, in the unconsciousness of matter. There is a guide there, but this falsehood keeps that guide numb. So we don't hear that voice which is there in the very cells of our body. Instinct, which is there to guide the insects and the animals and human beings, is disfigured, spoiled. There's this simple ray of truth which should be lighting up everything, the ray that is symbolized in Machimandya Chenga. But if a shadow falls across it, that hides, obscures the truth light in the heart cave, the deep cave where our soul lives. That truth light burns unwitnessed. Nobody sees it. In that altar crypt, special place of sacrifice that's hidden away behind the velamen, the secrecy. A velamen is a veil that veils the divine from the secular, the ordinary. In this way, this dim antagonist energy is born, the mother of evil. She mimes, she imitates the eternal mother's mighty shape and mocks her luminous infinity with this grey, distorted silhouette in the night. That's why it's been a kind of instinct in spiritual seekers to turn away from life, feeling that all this life, it's so distorted and it's impossible for us to cope with it. We just have to withdraw. And what she does is she slowed down the evolutionary process tremendously. Turiya, would you read?
Arresting the passion of the climbers, she forced on life a slow and orderly pace. Her hands deflecting and retarding it is led on the mystic evolution's curve. The tortuous line of her deceiving mind, the gods see not, and man is impotent. Oppressing the god's power within the soul, she forces back to the beast the human form. Yet, In her formidable instinctive mind, she feels the one goal in the heart of time and sees the immortal shine through the human mold. Alarmed for her rule and full of fear and rage, she crawls around each light that gleams through the dark, casting its ray on the spirit's lonely night, hoping to enter with fierce, stealthy pride, and in the cradle slay the divine star child. Incalculable are her strength and rules. Her touch is a fascination and a death. She kills her victim with his own delight. Even good, she makes a hook drag. For her, the world runs to its agony.
Thank you. She's pressing on the curve of evolution, slowing it down, diverting it into wrong direction. And the gods are not aware of the cosmic powers. And human beings don't seem to have the power to resist it. This is a conscious force which is opposed to the truth and the divine purpose. And many of the most dreadful things that we have heard about happening in history or see happening in the world today, they are a result of this influence and this action. And yet, she's aware that the one is growing in the heart of time, and she tries to stop it. She sees the possibility, the immortal possibility that's growing in this human substance. So she tries to stifle it. She's alarmed for her rule and full of fear and rage. She prowls around each light that gleams through the dark. It's as if the spirit pitched a tent in the desert, there's a little light, and there the divine child, the soul, has been born. And she wants to destroy it before it can live properly. Her strength and her ruse, her cunning, she is so clever. Her touch is a fascination and a death. Kills her victim with his own delight. And even good, we can see this virtue, she can turn that into a hook to drag the soul to hell. So many people become demonic simply through trying to be good. For her, the world runs to its agony. We wonder why we human beings are so stupid and how we can't live in a better way for her.
Often the pilgrim on the eternal's road, ill-lit from clouds by the pale moon of night, or in devious byways wandering alone, or lost in deserts where no path is seen, falls overpowered by her lion leaf, the conquered captive under her dreadful paws, intoxicated by burning breath and a murderous groan of a destroying mouth, once the companion of the sacred fire, the mortal perishes to God and light, an adversary governs heart and brain, the nature was tied to the mother force, the self of life yields up its titan and demoniac agencies that agonize earth nature and destroy. A cold fifth colonist is now self-sky, his subtle defeatist murmur slays the faith, and lodged in the breast or whispering from outside, a lying inspiration fell and dark. A new order substitutes for the divine.
Thank you. He says it happens often, pilgrim, on the road to the eternal, but he can't see his way very well. The clouds are covering pale moon of mind. The seeing soul has been covered up. So he's wandering in devious byways. He's strayed from the straight path. Or he's lost in deserts, wastelands, where it's impossible to find any path. And there, like a monster, she's waiting to leap on him, falls, overpowered by her lion leap. And then there's this description. It's said it happened that when people are attacked by wild animals, they may feel suddenly an attraction, a wish to be devoured by that creature. So here he refers to that. Intoxicated by a burning breath, an amorous groan of a destroying mouth. Once a companion of the sacred fire, the mortal perishes to God and life. He's got completely swallowed up and overtaken by this adversary force that governs his heart and his brain, nature that is hostile to the force of the Divine Mother. So everything surrenders. The life self allows itself to be used by these demoniac agencies to blow up, aggrandize the earth nature and disframe it, distort it, twist it.
The fifth columnist, you mean what?
It's, I think, a phrase that came up during the Spanish Civil War when the warning always was that, oh, the enemies are amongst us. We don't know who they are, but they are not the four columns of the army that we know about. There's a fifth column of traitors lurking in the society and working for the enemy, spies and double agents and so on. So he's also cowled, hidden, and he guides thought. And naturally, he's guiding it in the wrong way. Especially there's this suggestion that you can't win. You can't win against these forces. Better to collaborate. So when that adversary gets lodged in the breast, or even if it's only whispering in your ear, it's a lying inspiration, a terrible, dark, lying inspiration, substitutes the true divine order with a new order. And then there are these last lines that give the result of that. You'd like to read?
A silence falls upon the spirit's heights. From the veiled sanctuary, the god retires. Empty and cold is the chamber of the bride. The golden nimbus now is seen no more. No longer burns the white spiritual ray, and hushed forever is the secret voice. Then, by the angel of the vigil tower, a name is struck from the recording book. A flame that sang in heaven sinks quenched and mute. In ruin ends the epic of a soul. This is the tragedy of the inner death, when forfeited is the divine element, and only a mind and body live to die.
I think it's very clear. No? Anybody has anything to ask?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Is it that the soul just retires and leaves the person and goes to its own realm?
That's what Mother seems to suggest. That when the whole nature has been conquered, the soul withdraws. It's not there.
The soul's what?
The soul just withdraws. It doesn't remain. There's only a mind and body left, no soul.
No psychic being?
Withdraws, gone.
But there are, it said, people who don't have psychic being.
There are different kinds of people who don't have psychic being. This would be one kind.
What are the other?
I think Amal Kiran has written also about this, that there are beings who just choose to come and have a human experience. They come from other worlds, perhaps especially from the life world. They may come for progress, but they may just come for the experience.
But who may come for?
The experience.
A nimbus.
We see a nimbus here sometimes, a wonderful halo, glowing halo over the clouds. No, it's a special kind of cloud. There are times in Oroville, maybe it will come now, when we see the tall clouds, and then at sunset, above the cloud, there's like a halo, an aura of rainbow colors. Beautiful. So this is the golden nimbus, it's the aura.
Kind of like a rainbow.
Well, here he says the golden nimbus, but what we see is it has the rainbow colors. And here it says actually something is crossed out, no? As if the soul dies. My name is struck. Yeah, of course it's a kind of tradition that there are angels who are keeping an eye on everything, writing it all down, and especially noting how people are doing, how their souls are growing and obeying the law.
So this implies that psychic being would not be reborn again? That it ends? That the life of that psychic being ends?
I hope that wouldn't happen, because the divine spark might be expelled from that particular embodiment. But
is that what they call a lost soul?
That's a lost soul, for sure. Have you, do you know Bina Saxena's story, Seven Lives? Do you know that? Well, it's a beautiful book, and you ought to be able to get it somewhere. It was serialized in Mother India some years ago. And that tells somehow the story of a being who's come to this point that the divine spark is about to be extinguished, and how by the intervention of the Divine Mother it's brought back and given the opportunity to recover its former greatness. Seven Lives. It must be in the Ashram Archives library there, or probably Sri Aurobindo Ashram. Long after. Beautiful story.
Well, I have also a question. As I read or know, that the psychic presence is something which is in many levels, also animal and plants and all this. So even if the divine soul is not fully developed, is this divine presence not something on earth where living beings are connected?
Yes, it must be. But here he's speaking about how it can happen at our human level, that divine spark gets so swallowed up by the hostile forces that it can no longer act, at least in that particular embodiment. Yes. I think somebody must have asked Mother about whether he had a psychic being. No, of course it has left long ago. Oh, this is the tragedy of the living death, the inner death. All that's left is a mind and body. And they, unfortunately, the mind and the body, they will be devoured by the corresponding forces. There'll be nothing left to transmit to another incarnation.
I see the ghost, what you're describing, those black things.
So, but again, this question, why is it allowed? He deals with that in this next.
Is it possible for them to take a rebirth and pursue its journey for such souls? Can they take rebirth?
I don't know, dear. I don't know.
On page 225, it says, for terrible agencies the spirit allows.
Yeah, that's where we've reached. Shall we read on?
That's the thing. Mm-hmm. But as far as what Larry was asking and what I understood he said was that I wonder if, because the soul is said to be immortal, so I wonder if it just goes into the unmanifest. It has failed in its manifestation. Mm. It shows not to.
That's what I would understand, is that it withdraws from the manifestation.
Yeah.
And perhaps it is given a chance to come back again. I don't know. How could I possibly know these things? So let's read on. Who would be next? Would you read?
For terrible agencies the spirit allows, and there are subtle and enormous powers that shield themselves with the covering ignorance. Offspring of the gods, agents of the shadowy force, haters of light, intolerant of peace, aping to the thought the shining friend and guide, opposing in the heart the eternal will. They wield the awkward, uplifting harmonist. His wisdom's oracles are made our bonds. The doors of God they have locked with keys of greed, and shut out by the law his tireless grace. Along all nature's lines they have set their posts, and intercept the caravans of light. Wherever the gods act, they intervene. A yoke is laid upon the world's dim heart. Masked are its beats from the supernal bliss, and the closed peripheries of brilliant mind block the fine entries of celestial fire.
Thank you. So this is really a warning, isn't it? We have to be aware. Why is Sri Aurobindo telling us this? We shouldn't take things too lightly. The spirit allows terrible agencies, and there are subtle and enormous powers that shield themselves with the covering ignorance. We are so ignorant, we can't detect them. These powers are really haters of light, intolerant of peace, and they pretend to be the shining friend and guide, posing in the heart the eternal will. They veil the occult uplifting harmonist, that wonderful power of harmony and light and truth that wants to lift us up out of the ignorance. The scriptures, God's oracles of wisdom, are made our bonds. It's like they keep us tied tight. They've locked the doors of God with keys of creed. You have to believe this or else. And this prevents the spontaneous movements of the soul. And by the law, these powers have shut out God's tireless grace. And they're dominating all nature, all nature's lines. They've set their posts. And there are caravans of light. There are messengers of light coming with wonderful gifts to share with us. They intercept them. Wherever the gods act, they intervene. So it's as if the heart of the world is bearing a yoke, a heavy burden that keeps it like a slave. So the beats of the heart are hit by mass, hidden from the supernal bliss. We don't feel that. And we have this brilliant mind, which is so shiny and bright and convincing and interesting, but this blocks those fine entries of the celestial fire, the heavenly fire of intuition and inspiration. We can read a little further. Lady back there, would you like to read? Would you read?
Always the dark adventurers seem to win. Nature, the filled with errors, institutes, turned into defeats, the victories of truth, proclaimed as falsehoods the eternal laws, and load the dice of doom with wizard lies. The world's shrines they have occupied, usurped its thrones. In scorn of the dwindling chances of the gods, they claim creation as their conquered
fief,
and crown themselves the iron lords of time. Adepts of the illusion and the mask, the artificers of nature's fall and pain, have built their altars of triumphant night in the clay temple of terrestrial life. In the vacant precincts of the sacred fire, in front of the reredos in the mystic rite, facing the dim villain none can pierce, intones his solemn hymn, the mitred priest, invoking their dreadful presence in his breast, attributing to them the awful name. He chants the syllables of the magic text, and summons the unseen communion's act, while twixt the incense and the muttered prayer, all the fierce veil with which the world is wrapped is mixed in the holy chalice of man's heart and poured to them like sacramental wine.
Let's pause there. They've occupied the world shrines, usurped its thrones. They've really corrupted religion, and those priests who are supposed to be leading and guiding human beings towards the divine, they're just doing the opposite. He's invoking dreadful presence of these adversaries, giving them that name which we think of with awe, than the divine name. He's chanting the syllables of the magic text. It's really like a black mass that summons these beings to communion. So there's the incense that's supposed to carry our offering to the divine, the muttered prayer. The priest is preparing the wine, which has to be offered. But instead of that divine wine, all the fierce bale, all the terrible suffering and evil which is torturing the world is mixed in this chalice, in this sacred cup, and it's bubbling and foaming, poured out to these adversary powers like sacramental wine. Terrible.
This morning I listened a Chanda 1969, and was it said when you fell 290 block the fine entry of the celestial fire? Was it explained the desire? The desire to block the descent of the it's very fantastic explanation of the
please. Nature, if you in your institute, what do you mean by institute?
Can you tell me the line?
209.
Nature they fill with evil's institutes. Yes. Institutes are establishments, aren't they? governments and banks and universities and all these things. And these adversaries, they seem to be controlling the world. We can see it like that. They're filling all this earth nature with evil's institutes.
And what is Revelos?
It's that screen in a cathedral or church which separates the congregation from the choir and where the priest does all this business. They usually very beautiful carved wooden screens, maybe gilded. Oh, there's the Reredos. He's in front of the Reredos. He's going to perform the communion so that the people can see him. And he's facing this velamen, this veil, which separates the sacred precinct from the place where the ordinary people are. He's chanting the Mass, but it's a black Mass. He's invoking the dreadful presences of these adverse beings. Sudhanya, would you read, please? Line 232, assuming names divine.
Assuming names divine, the guide and the opponent of the highest day have come out of the wall of sinless thought and awe. They serve by ability of ability capacities through. Mind is their refuge and strategy is against the shore of rain, the luminous eye, Western, the leading massive folk of doom, calm and secure in sunless privacy. No wandering ray of them can enter there, or more protected by the little mass as in a studio of creative death. The charming songs of practice, sweet and bad, the drama of the art that present stays. All who would praise the calling or must come under the glorious arts of their power. Children, the radiant children of the gods, the dark and the glorious, peace and dreadful light. None can visit them who has not passed through hell.
So these powers have come specifically to oppose the Supreme. They've come out of this terrible world and they hide in the night. But he says they do serve by enmity, cosmic scheme. This is interesting. By their opposition, they are doing something necessary. But what they're doing is opposing, and they are planning the drama of the earth, their tragic state. They're responsible for all the terrible things that happen. So all who really want to raise up the fallen world have to pass under the dangerous arches of their power. Because they have been given this privilege. They're allowed to darken the radiant children of the God. That's their right. This means that none can reach heaven who has not passed through hell.
That's the purpose of hell.
I don't know whether that's the purpose of hell.
If somebody has been really good all their life, and then they cannot go to heaven,
no, it means in order to be really complete, you have to have faced this darkness, seen it and faced it. And it says, no, that we read it in the previous canto. Then you have to be like a warrior, carry your sword and keep your eye out, and how you can pass. So that's what King Aswapati is doing in his circle. What is the root of all this? Where has it come from? How can it be changed? And that is described in the last section, which we'll take up next time. When he finds it, he's immediately projected into the heavens of the life gods. So we'll hear that music
and
now.
And then the announcement of the Sarupi.
Yes. When we've listened to the...
Thank you. stomach and core of all that marvelous world. A part stood high Elysian nameless hills, burning like sunset in a trance. Their slopes through a hurry of laughter and voices sunk, crossed by a song of singing rivulets, adoring blue heaven with their happy hymns, down into worlds of shadowy secrecy.
To Sheldon.